for joining us for this evening's public lecture. My name is John Dewar, the Provost of the University of Melbourne. To begin proceedings, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations. I also pay my respects to the Indigenous elders past and present. Now, tonight's proceedings are being recorded, so I'd be grateful if you could turn off pagers, mobile phones, and any other devices that might unexpectedly spring noisily into life during Malcolm's talk. Tonight's lecture on politics, journalism, and the 24/7 news cycle takes place at a time of some confusion about the future of the media. For many people, the rise of social media and Britain's phone hacking saga have led to some sharp questions about the role and purpose of journalism. WikiLeaks clouds the media landscape even further. So with the authority of traditional media looking increasingly dubious, is there anywhere to which we can turn for a clear view of the world and journalism's place in it? Well, fortunately, there is. A few centres of clear-headed wisdom on all things media and all things journalistic do exist. Tonight's lecture is hosted by one of those centres, the Centre for Advanced Journalism. And this lecture will be delivered by a speaker who brings a rare degree of authority to speak on the subject in the shape of the Shadow Minister for Communications, Malcolm Turnbull. Welcome, Malcolm. A quick word on the Centre for Advanced Journalism first. It was established in 2009 and offers a great deal to today's media marketplace. Its offerings include a series of outstanding public lectures and conversations, of which tonight is one. Earlier lecturers have included Paul Keating on the privacy imperative in today's information free-for-all, Tim Costello on the good and bad of disaster reporting, and John Howard with perhaps the most comprehensive title of all, Politics and the Media, the Good, the Bad and the Ugly. The Centre also supports the A.N. Smith Journalism Lecture with significant contributions in recent years by Mark Scott, the Managing Director of the ABC, ABC journalist Annabel Crabb, and Chief Executive and Managing Director of Fairfax Media, Greg Highwood. The Centre also offers outstanding new educational possibilities for the journalistic leaders of the future. Next year, the Centre will offer its new postgraduate degree, the Master of Journalism, to help shape the next generation of senior media professionals. And the Centre's staff are led by distinguished media professionals, including Michael Gawenda, from whom we'll hear more later on, and its new director, Margaret Simons, who took up that role just this week. And they're both guided by an outstanding advisory committee. Now, our lecturer tonight, Malcolm Turnbull, brings with him a quiver full of arrows for getting to the core of today's media troubles. In the first case, he's vastly experienced as a politician in the cut and thrust of day-to-day engagement with journalists and the media. And as you probably know, he's the Shadow Minister for Communications and Broadband and the Federal Member for Wentworth. He previously served in the Howard government as Minister for Environment and Water Resources. He was later Leader of the Opposition for more than a year and before that, Shadow Treasurer. Indeed, even before he entered Federal Parliament in 2004, Malcolm Turnbull was familiar to many journalists and members of the public as a leading member of the Australian Republican Movement. But Malcolm also brings significant and broad journalistic expertise to tonight's lecture. In the late 70s, he worked for several newspapers in Australia and in Britain, as well as in radio and television. He later went on to achieve a professional distinction as a lawyer and businessman. A graduate of Sydney and Oxford universities with degrees in arts and law, his legal cases included a famous defence of the former MI5 agent Peter Wright over the publication of Peter Wright's memoirs, Spycatcher. If you recall, the publication of Spycatcher was strongly opposed by the Thatcher government. And I think, Malcolm, you still keep your hand in with some modest journalistic output through your dog blogs on your website. Do they? Of course they do, Malcolm, including Yo-Yo's visit to his local MP, which I greatly enjoyed. Mr. Turnbull has also established his own investment banking firm in 1987, and around that time co-founded a number of companies, including Australia's first large internet service provider, AusEmail Limited. So Malcolm brings a unique set of career perspectives to the ongoing conversations fostered by the Centre for Advanced Journalism. And I confidently expect that he'll bring that conversation fully alive tonight. Now, in recent days, we've seen Malcolm Turnbull in the combative role of Shadow Communications Minister, attacking, amongst other things, the Gillard government's decision to abandon the tender process for the Australian network. Wherever he takes us this evening, the lecture promises a lively discussion about the future of journalism in a post-print world. I'm delighted that Malcolm has agreed to take audience questions after the lecture. He will speak for about 30 minutes, and then the Q&A will be moderated by Michael Gawenda. Ladies and gentlemen, on the topic of politics, journalism, and the 24/7 news cycle, please welcome Malcolm Turnbull.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great, great pleasure, great privilege to be here. Now, 33 years ago, when I joined the newsroom of the London Sunday Times, its editor, Harry Evans, gave me Editing and Design, a five-volume manual of English typography and layout. He inscribed them to Malcolm with a warm welcome to the grubby ranks of the hot metal men, Harry. Now, rereading those volumes today, it's remarkable how much is as relevant as it was in the 1970s. Good design, clear expression, accurate and engaging reporting. The objectives are the same, only the context has changed. And that perhaps should be the theme, or a theme, of my remarks tonight. We lament the death of many newspapers and the loss of thousands of journalist jobs. But just as the craft of the journalist is as enduring and important, regardless of the medium by which it is practiced, print, radio, television, and now the whole converging digital domain, so too is the importance of journalism, honest and ethical, fearless and independent, responsible and accurate journalism. For without it, we will struggle to remain a free society, struggle indeed to remain a democracy. Now, I'd come to London in 1978 with a bit of reputation as a journalist and debater, ostensibly to study at Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship. During my time at Sydney University, I'd managed to fit in a busy life as a reporter while completing my law degree, and I thought I might do the same in England. I'd first met Harold Evans. He was the great editor of the Sunday Times. To say that he was a hero to every young journalist in that time is an understatement. He was an absolute prince of print. He was the head of the Sunday Times, its editor, which of course had pioneered investigative journalism, most notably revealing the horrors of thalidomide. So really a great, great role model for any young journalist. So I'd met Harry in the most dramatic and romantic circumstances, and I relate this tonight because I know there are some young would-be journalists here and young journalists here, and this might appeal to them. I'd gone to England a few years before to do some debating. I was still a student, and I was speaking in a debate at Cambridge University in the Cambridge Union. Harold Evans, you know, the great man, was one of the paper speakers, and I was well down the batting order. Nonetheless, I gave a reasonably good speech, apparently, because afterwards a note was passed through the audience to me, and I opened it up, and it had the letterhead of the Sunday Times on it. And on it, Harry Evans had written, "Good speech, come and see me in the Gray's Inn Road tomorrow." This was like an invitation to come and see God. The next day, Harry offered me a job on the spot. And when I said I had to go back to Australia to finish my law degree, he said, "Don't do that. Think of what awaits you. Law will certainly make you more money than journalism. But where does it end? Chief Justice? Or much worse?" And then he shivered a little. "You could end up a politician." I did go back to Australia, and I did finish my law degree, and I continued working as a reporter and stayed in touch with Harry. And by the time I returned to London, no doubt because I was young and cheap, I had an offer to work at the Sunday Times and also at The Observer, which at that time was edited by Donald Trelford, another great editor. At the time, the Thompsons, who are owners of the Sunday Times and the Times, were in trench warfare with the printing unions as they tried to reform the truly extraordinarily inefficient work practices, which were threatening the financial viability of what should have been a very, very profitable newspaper group. My head told me to go to the Observer. There was no pending stoppage there, but my heart allowed me to be persuaded by Harry that everything would be sorted out next Thursday week or thereabouts, and so I started at the Gray's Inn Road. It was a really weird period. The journalists did a deal with the management, and we stayed on the payroll. The printing unions did not and were locked out. And so, week after week, we wrote stories and prepared papers which were ready to go out when the breakthrough came, as it apparently nearly did, just about every week, or so we were told. Well, it didn't, and finally, after nearly a year of closure, a settlement was reached. The papers were back on the street in November of 79. 2 years later, Murdoch bought Times newspapers and then proceeded to break the power of the print unions through his 1986 move to Wapping and more rational work practices. The newspaper industry had been on the edge of an abyss at that time, and Wapping took it back from the brink, and the rest of Fleet Street followed and survived to prosper. Now, having got off to that good start as a journalist, of course, my career has been in decline ever since. A lawyer, banker, entrepreneur, colourful Sydney business identity, and now, as Harry had feared, a politician. So what's next? That's too terrible to contemplate. But along the way, I've had a lot to do with the newspaper and media business generally. I was involved in selling and buying back the Nine Network for Kerry Packer, restructuring and later helping to take over John Fairfax, restructuring the Ten Network from being the third rating and least profitable network to being the third rating and most profitable network, and of course, as was mentioned earlier with Sean Howard and my old bulletin editor Trevor Kennedy, founding Aussie Mail. And naturally, as a politician, I have an especially keen interest in the media. After all, as my darling wife Lucy often observes, in Canberra, the politicians are the foxes and the press gallery are the hounds. There is a media inquiry going on at the moment, which was, as we know, set up by the government with the aim of taking a swipe at News Corporation in the wake of the shocking crimes and misconduct at the News of the World. The Leveson inquiry, which is the UK's judicial inquiry into the whole affair, is exposing a cynical corruption in the British press that will surprise and shock even those like myself who are brought up on the old ditty, "Thank God one cannot bribe nor twist the honest British journalist, for seeing what he does unbribed, there is no need to do so." But mercifully, there does not appear to be any evidence of phone hacking or similar crimes in Australia. I wouldn't be complacent about that, by the way, but on the face of it, our media seem relatively responsible by comparison, which gives me a small bit of pleasure, because when I was working in London, the Brits on Fleet Street always used to complain that the Australians were lowering the tone. But this rather begs the question of whether the inquiry headed by Ray Finkelstein QC needs to be happening at all. I suspect it will do little harm, but not much good. It is spending a lot of time, it seems, discussing whether the Press Council has sufficient teeth or should be buttressed with government regulation of the kind that applies to the broadcast media. And those who listen to the Sydney Shock Jocks can attest what a salutary and therapeutic influence the ACMA has on their commitment to accuracy and balance and reliability. It also seems to be considering the iniquities of the concentration of metropolitan daily newspaper ownership in the hands of News Corporation. Whatever the merits of that dispensation, approved, I might add, by Paul Keating, it has been in place since 1986, and the slice of the overall news media pie occupied by daily newspapers is shrinking. However, the big issue, the whale in the bay, which we should be analysing and discussing, is the very future, the viability of journalism itself. Rather than spending too much time on how many newspapers are owned by Rupert Murdoch, we should be asking whether there will be any newspapers left for him, or indeed anybody else, to own at all. What sort of democracy, what sort of society will we have if there is no Age, no Herald Sun, no Sydney Morning Herald, no Australian? What sort of democracy will we have if the great newspapers which have formed the foundation of news gathering, reporting and analysis are replaced by what? A sea of blogs and tweets. Now, around the developed world, newspaper revenues and profits have plunged. Hundreds have been closed. Many more are struggling to survive. There are so many examples, but let's consider two of the greatest newspaper groups in the world: the Fairfax Group here in Australia and the New York Times Company in the United States. As of last Friday, their shares had each lost about 85% of their value from their height about 10 years ago. I don't need to labour the statistics with you, but in a nutshell, the picture is like this. Newspaper circulations have declined in most developed countries. In Australia, with a stronger economy, they've declined by 3% between 2007 and 2009. In New Zealand, the decline is 13%, in the UK, 21%, in the United States, 30%. And that was, of course, before the closure of the News of the World. However, the circulation story is rather misleading. Most newspapers have more readers now than they have ever had. Their print circulation and readership has declined, markedly in some cases, but their online readership has exploded. The Sydney Morning Herald claims 1 million readers on the weekend. Nielsen Online records it as having 3 million monthly unique users as of their October survey. So the problem, therefore, is not lack of readers, but lack of revenue. Since 2002, total spending on advertising in Australia has grown by 60%. Spending on television has grown 40.5%. Spending on newspapers has grown by 19%. Spending online has grown by a massive 13.5 times. Another measure is that between 2000 and 2010, the shares of total advertising spend in Australia, excluding search engines, changed dramatically. Newspapers down from 45 to 31%, magazines down from 8 to 6, television down from 34 to 33, pretty resilient, radio down from 9 to 8, outdoor steady at 4%, and online rose from close to 0 to 18%. And if the figures included search as well, which is where most of the online advertising revenues go, the online share would be even greater. Now, in the United States, on the other hand, where the picture is much more grim, newspaper ad revenues have dropped 47% from 2005 to 2009, and over the same period, cut their editorial spending by $1.6 billion a year, or 25%. Staff at daily newspapers there have shrunk by more than 25% since 2006. Television network news staffs and news magazine reporting staffs have halved since the late 80s, the last 20 years. Is Australia so different, or is this a case of you ain't seen nothing yet? Traditionally, newspapers have divided their advertising into classifieds and display. And in Australia, the classifieds were dominated by the big metropolitan news broadsheets, in particular, this city's The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald, which only a decade ago, that's to say those classifieds only a decade ago, provided nearly two-thirds of that group's revenues. Newspaper classifieds have not quite vanished, but one newspaper chief executive told me last week they hope to keep a quarter of the old classified revenue by diverting it into, albeit very low-yielding, display advertising. So far, this was largely real estate, but of course, as we know, as the online vehicles for real estate advertising are becoming more and more compelling, it's questionable how long newspapers can hang on to that category. The problem is not simply that the online environment provides another competitive platform for the delivery of news, entertainment, information, and advertising, but that the online space, the digital domain, is a far more efficient and cost-effective means of delivering any advertising, which could be described as demand fulfillment. That's to say, enabling us to find something we're looking for, whether it's a flat, a car, or a job, as opposed to demand creation, promoting brands, products, in a manner designed to attract and engage the attention of the reader. So analytically, you could say that in advertising for demand fulfillment, online search simply kills any printed classified section or directory publication. It is the better mousetrap. In terms of display, the online world offers a big new competitor. It doesn't actually represent a killer application, if you like. And so in that regard, it doesn't really matter whether newspapers' readership are up or down. The internet simply offers a better solution for what has been a very, very large part of newspapers' advertising base, so large and secure that they used to be called the rivers of gold. Now, Rupert Murdoch once observed that the internet will destroy more profitable businesses than it will create. And he was certainly right, at least so far as his empire is concerned. Closer to home, the value created for the shareholders of SEEK, or REA Group, for example, appears to be, especially if you look at it on an earnings base, much less than the value lost to the digital world by the shareholders of Fairfax. Newspapers have created a platform for advertisers by producing sufficiently interesting content to attract a large mass of readers. That content is very costly to produce. Journalists have to eat and drink, I'm told. Television and radio, in somewhat different ways, does the same thing. So it is galling that the two current giants of the online world, Google and Facebook, create very little content of their own. Google is above all a search engine and an aggregator of other people's content. It produces very little content of its own, some applications and services, and certainly no journalism. Facebook, which has 800 million subscribers who use it at least once a month, produces no content of its own. Its users do that. Ken Doctor of Newsonomics in the US has estimated that 63% of online digital advertising in the US goes to these aggregators and search engines: Google, Facebook, Yahoo, AOL, Microsoft, and a few others. And above all, the biggest share goes to Google. In the United States, this is the Pew Foundation's 2011 State of the News Media, found that online advertising revenue has now surpassed that of the printed newspapers. Search alone, dominated by Google and Yahoo, according to Pew, attracts 48% of all online advertising. Has the algorithm trumped journalism? I've not been able to find any authoritative numbers for the Australian scene, but the chief executive of one of the leading online platforms here told me recently that Google so dominated the Australian market, its revenues were 5 times that of its nearest competitors, including Yahoo 7, Fairfax, or 9 MSN. Nielsen Online's latest unique audience numbers for Australian sites in October are dominated by Google with 14 million, Facebook and 9 MSN at 11 million, at number 13, ABC Online with 3.5 million, and at 20, the Sydney Morning Herald, or SMH, with 3 million. So the newspaper, the best rating newspaper, is only at number 20 with a unique audience that is about 20% of that of Google. In the top 20 Australian sites, by that measure, only the ABC and the SMH, Herald, have got a substantial investment, and Yahoo 7 and 9 MSN a much lesser investment in journalism. It does all seem very unfair. Now, newspapers are busily experimenting with different models. Traditionally, and I suspect in hindsight, very mistakenly, online news was free. And once given free access, readers felt it was their entitlement. There are at least two big questions here. Will enough readers pay enough money to view online news to offset the loss of advertising revenues from the printed medium? What is the best paywall model that will hit the sweet spot of subscription revenue and at the same time ensure there are enough readers to maintain advertising yields? The jury is out on both, but I'll venture some early observations about what seems to me to be working and what is not. Financial newspapers, preeminently the FT and the Wall Street Journal, have an enormous advantage. The business community is used to paying for financial news and information, and it is no surprise both papers are doing well in terms of their online-only subscriptions. In terms of general newspapers, the most successful so far appears to be the New York Times, which as of October had 360,000 digital subscribers. The New York Times offers a freemium model whereby readers can access up to, currently, 20 articles a month for free, after which they have to subscribe. The FT has a similar approach. The advantage of the freemium model is that the paper's articles can be linked in search engines and above all social media like Twitter and Facebook. On the other hand, Murdoch's Times of London approach has an impermeable paywall which prevents that kind of linking. The consequence, however, is that the newspaper becomes effectively invisible in the online world other than to its handful of paid subscribers. The freemium and other models will continue to be tweaked, but it seems that it is the better approach, at least so far, but this is very early days. Now, the arrival of the tablet and smartphones offer what will become, for most people, their principal device for viewing digital content. Apps offer the ability to provide a very compelling and magazine-like reading experience. The Economist app, for example, is eerily close to the experience of reading the magazine itself. However, while the tablets offer the opportunity to provide a better digital format, they also potentially provide even more competition with the printed newspaper because they enable us to read online news in settings which have been even less amenable to a computer and thus had remained the preserve of print. The train, the bus, on the couch or in bed. The peak time for reading the SMH and Age apps on the iPad is apparently in bed. What this is going to do to the sex life of Australia remains to be seen. They've got a lot to answer for, those people at Fairfax. So the problem has been summed up in one phrase in the States, and I think it's a fair one, is to say that at the moment the industry is exchanging print dollars for digital dimes. More readers overall, but the revenues in the online space are a very small fraction of what was available in the printed medium. And of course, because it's more cost effective, because it's cheaper, that side of the business is growing. Now, what does this brave new world mean for journalism? Not that the thousands enrolled in journalism and media courses seem to have noticed, but self-evidently fewer journalists. Whichever way you look at it, newsrooms are shrinking, if not closing. The Canberra Press Gallery, for example, has gone from 283 journalists in 1990 to 190 today. A decade ago, the Sydney Morning Herald and Sun Herald had an editorial staff of 500. Now it's about 300. The Age's newsroom has shrunk by a quarter over the last 5 years. I'll spare you more grim statistics in the same vein, but the short and obvious point is that as newspapers' profits dwindle, if not disappear, so does their capacity to employ journalists. Now, it's easy to be sentimental about the decline of newspapers, but tonight I want to reflect on the way these changes to the news business are impacting on both the quality of journalism and the quality of our democracy. The first point to make is that the decline in newspapers goes right to the very heart of the news industry. As those of us who've worked in the electronic media know very well, the newspapers traditionally have been the news foundation which the rest of the media have built on and more often than not simply rerun. The reason for that, of course, was that the newspapers had both the space to cover the widest range of news and the staff to do it. Because most broadcast news has much less capacity, a smaller news hole, you could say, its journalistic resources have also been smaller and more targeted than newspapers. The emerging exception to this is the ABC, of which I'll say a little later. The consequence of this decline in journalism is that too many important matters of public interest are either not covered at all or covered superficially. At the local level, there is much less attention paid to local councils and even state parliaments than there used to be. There hasn't been a really thorough analysis of this in Australia, but in the United States, there has been a growing alarm at the loss of more than 13,000 newspaper newsroom jobs in the last 4 years, and the dramatic declines in political reporters at every level, as well as declines in reporters with special beats such as health, education, or the environment. Now, this raises real risks for democracy. Her Majesty's loyal opposition does its best with very limited resources, but more often than not, the most effective means of holding a government to account is through a vigorous and independent media. During the last appalling term of the New South Wales Labor government, the most rigorous and consistent criticism came from the Sydney Morning Herald and the Daily Telegraph. This is not to take anything away from Barry O'Farrell's opposition, but any critique offered by an opposition is always viewed with scepticism by the public. They would say that, wouldn't they? The most effective check and balance on government has always been an independent press which maintains its credibility by ensuring that its criticism is balanced and based on fact, based indeed on solid journalistic work. And that is the risk of excessive partisanship or bias. The less objective, the more shrill a paper or a broadcaster or a journalist appears, the less credibility they have. Another consequence of this decline in newspapers is that journalists have less time to do the hard, time-consuming slog of researching and investigating stories in the way they did before. Those newspapers, like The Age here in Melbourne, that remain committed to investigative journalism, know that it comes at a high cost and that its greatest threat is not a writ for libel, no matter how skillfully defended, but the company accountant. Consider the shrinking Canberra Press Gallery. The vast bulk of its coverage of federal politics is now about personalities and the game of politics. Readers seeking a better understanding of how the carbon tax or the mining tax, for example, will operate, will often struggle to find much assistance in the output of the gallery, with some very honourable exceptions, compared to the millions of words written about Kevin Rudd versus Julia Gillard, let alone Tony Abbott's budgie smugglers. There is a reason for this. You can knock out a piece on the personalities of politics in a few minutes, a couple of phone calls to the usual anonymous sources for some party room gossip, and away you go. But in the midst of all the blasts and counterblasts from vested interests, pro and con, about the mining tax, for example, where is there the rigorous analysis that cuts through the inevitably exaggerated claims of both sides? I'm sure someone will find and point me to a few examples, but they would have been hard to find and easy to miss in the welter of reporting on the game. The consequence of all of this has been that what we used to call the 24-hour news cycle has become instead an opinion cycle. Certainly, declining revenues have contributed to this. Research and reporting, especially investigative reporting, is very expensive. Opinion, on the other hand, is cheap. And given most people do not go into journalism any more than they go into politics because they are shy and retiring, having a column of your own in which to pontificate carries far more status and weight than actually reporting the news or explaining the latest legislation or policy. But there is another and potentially more troubling factor that is leading to the substitution of opinion for news. Over the last few decades, we've seen a proliferation of mediums through which news and information can be viewed. In my youth as a reporter, we were limited to the newspapers, more then than now, a few television stations, a few more radio stations, and a handful of magazines. In terms of reaching mass audiences, for news, the most influential media were the big papers and the TV stations. News magazines, apologies to my old alma mater, The Bulletin, now deceased, were never a big deal in Australia. And because these mass media business depended on them reaching a mass audience, they had to strive to achieve some kind of breadth and balance that could accommodate a wide range of interests with a wide range of views, a wide range of readers with a wide range of views. As Arthur Miller said, a good newspaper is a nation talking to itself. However, while newspapers and magazines have declined, the various electronic media have exploded, first radio stations, then cable television, and now the internet with an almost infinite range of platforms catering for every interest or opinion. And the consequence has been that very often the most successful media business model is no longer to be the nation talking to itself, with all of the diversity that implies, but rather a narrow section of the nation talking to itself. The proliferation of outlets that digital technology has enabled has itself contributed to the changing nature of what we regard as news and the way in which many citizens perceive politics. in a phrase usually attributed to the late Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the senator from New York, everyone is entitled to their own opinions, but they are not entitled to their own facts. In the era when much of society shared the common ground of the news bulletins on three or four great broadcast networks, this was true. But today, if we think of the United States, liberals can get the facts as well as the opinions they want from MSNBC, conservatives can do likewise from Fox News, and the declining number of voters in the middle can tune into CNN. Not only will each obtain the opinions they want to hear, the offering of which has turned out to be a vastly profitable commercial opportunity, particularly for Fox, but also increasingly the facts that support their preconceptions. Little wonder that Stephen Colbert, the host of that very amusing conservative TV show on Comedy Central, has satirised what he described as truthiness, a fact that someone claims to know intuitively without regard to evidence, logic, or the objective facts. Facts that feel right are in too much of our public discourse held above truth itself. Now, we are not yet to the point in Australia where those on different sides of any given issue have completely different understandings of the objective reality underlining their stances. But sometimes, on some issues, we are too close. Climate change springs to mind. Now, while I would not seek to propose any new law to diminish or restrain the right of any person or publisher to express the most trenchant, partisan, or indeed mistaken opinions, we must ask ourselves this question: is there a risk that in this proliferation of opinion, this electronic 21st century version of a snowstorm of 18th century pamphleteers, we lose sight of the reasonable point of view in the middle? Do we run the risk that every opinion we see or hear is an angry and indignant one? Now, we are a long way from the United States in this regard, but I think it is a fair observation to say that their politics has become more negative and more bitterly partisan, and that this has been reflected in and amplified by more partisan media, whether it is the cable news channels or the ferocity of much of the blogosphere. Many people have argued that the internet offers the chance for citizens' journalism, whether it is small news websites, personal blogs, or Twitter streams. There's no doubt that wireless broadband and smartphones have revolutionised news gathering. Right now, several billion people around the world have the ability to take a picture, a short movie, and upload to the internet, where conceivably it could be seen by millions within minutes. If the Assad regime finally falls in Syria, the pictures of police brutality posted from Syrian smartphones will have had no small part in it. And at a rather less heroic level, I'm still amazed that I can, as I did on Monday night, knock out a blog on my iPad, post it on my website, tweet it, and in those few minutes, draw it to the attention of more than 77,000 people. Yet if the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age and The Australian and others, and even The New York Times, were to close or shrink to shadows, do we really imagine that the great task of reporting, explaining, investigating the powerful and holding them to account can be taken over by Twitter and by Facebook? I doubt it. Our society needs journalism, and we need journalists. We need a free, well-resourced and independent media as much as we need our politicians and our parliaments. We do not need, as Jefferson surmised, to consider whether we would rather have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government. We need to have both. So what is to be done? Well, we need to recognise that the whole edifice of our fifth estate, of our journalism, has been built on a foundation of newspaper journalism, and that that foundation is crumbling. The management of the media companies will deny that the end is nigh. I hope they're right, but we shouldn't assume, Micawber-like, that something, the iPad perhaps, will turn up to set things right. Life after newspapers is not just an issue for reporters and journalists. We're very unfortunate, indeed, in Australia to have the ABC and, of course, the SBS, our public broadcasters. The ABC's importance in Australian news and journalism grows apace, partly because the rest of the industry, which is funded by diminishing advertising dollars is in decline, and partly because it has expanded its journalistic output and the reach of that output with a 24-hour news channel, online news coverage, which is more than just transcripts and summaries, and of course through podcasts and iView, which is particularly the podcasts of a lot of Radio National's journalism, has significantly expanded the reach of that work. The news output of the ABC, indeed, has never been bigger nor its reach wider. It's far from perfect, but it does have an obligation to be balanced, which it takes seriously. I think it helps to have the ABC run by someone at the moment who comes from the news rather than the entertainment side of the business. There's been a lot of discussion about not-for-profit online news publications like ProPublica in the United States. The idea of philanthropic tax-advantaged support for quality media is superficially enticing. In a way, it's not so distant from the world we've known until now, where the ownership of media assets has often been associated with a particular type of individual, usually described by the shorthand term media mogul, whose motivations were not simply commercial. ProPublica in the US is an online media outlet, I'm sure many of you have read it, which has won plaudits and prizes for the quality of its investigative journalism and which has been supported in financial terms by a long list of respected charitable trusts. It was founded and most significantly backed by the Sandler family, and the critics of ProPublica, who don't like its politics, have latched onto the way they made their money by selling a home mortgage business to Wachovia Bank, which subsequently went bust shortly before the subprime mortgage implosion and the GFC which followed. The Pew Research Center has looked at not-for-profits in this space as a business model and found that 44% were clearly of an ideological nature. They noted, however, that sites that offered a mixed or balanced political perspective tended to have multiple funders, more revenue streams, more transparency, and indeed more content with a deeper bench of reporters. In a sense, there's nothing new in this. Why should we be surprised sponsors of not-for-profit online or indeed hard copy newspapers are motivated by political agendas? There's a long list of press barons, past and present, who've owned and often subsidised newspapers for no reason other than the power and influence it brought them. Overall, I think there's more to welcome than to fear in philanthropic sponsors of newspapers. Some will be biased to left and right, but not all of them will be, and if they wish to attract a wider range of sponsors to share the expenses, they'll be wary of extremism. This will come into focus in Australia early next year when Graham Wood, the very successful entrepreneur behind What If and hefty donor to the Greens, launches his Global Mail, with former ABC reporter Monica Attard at the helm and other respected journalists on the payroll. Mr. Wood shouldn't be surprised, however, if his vehicle is treated with scepticism, at least at the outset. But the Packers, the Murdochs and the Fairfaxes have all used their papers and media to run political agendas, and ultimately the calibre and balance of any newspaper is judged by its readers, who have more interest in the journalism and the owner's commitment to that journalism, no matter how controversial, than to his or her political interests. Many governments have provided subsidies to newspapers to keep them afloat. That's not, in fact, an entirely new phenomenon. The establishment of the US Postal Service in 1775 was in large part to enable newspapers to be more widely and inexpensively distributed across the country, and it really was the platform upon which the American newspaper industry started to grow, where it went from being pamphlets, effectively, to being proper newspapers. However, I don't think there would be any enthusiasm either in newsrooms or in Canberra for government subsidies to go to newspapers, be they hard copy or online. There is, however, the precedent of the public broadcasters, but their funding is entirely from government, that's to say the ABC's is entirely from government, locked in over a long term and buttressed by a strong culture of independence. However, there would be some merit in considering whether a level of support could be given in terms of deductible gift recipient status for not-for-profit newspapers, and I'm talking online or hard copy here or both, which committed to a code of conduct analogous perhaps to that subscribed to by the ABC. I simply pose this as something to consider. At this stage, I regret to say the coalition, given the extravagance of the incumbent government, is looking for ways to cut expenditure. But in the interests of looking beyond the next few weeks or even the next few years, we should also be looking hard now and discussing seriously now how we ensure the survival of journalism. We will not know how significant it was to our democracy until it is gone, and we shouldn't be in denial about it. I'm against denialism of all kinds. Now, I imagine that many of you here are students of journalism and no doubt worry that you're stepping into an industry which is about to expire. Well, it's not that bad. You are not signing up as cabin boy on the Titanic's last voyage. But your journey of journalism will be potentially the most exciting of all. At times like this, when the establishment is shaken to its foundations and the old order changeth, yielding place to new, the young and the enterprising have the chance to take what is enduring, objectivity, accuracy, fearless independence, and build new platforms from which to launch their journalism. So embrace the new world. We're counting on you to do it. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for that, Malcolm. It was a wonderful speech. I think you'll all agree with me about that. It's wonderful to hear a senior Liberal praising the ABC. These are rare moments indeed in our current climate, but it's most welcome, I have to say. My name is Michael Gawenda, for those of you who don't know me, and I'm the outgoing director of the Centre for Advanced Journalism. We've just welcomed our new director. She couldn't be here tonight because she's away, but she'll be on the ball, on the job from next Monday, and so we're looking forward to the centre growing and developing, and we're certainly looking forward to the launch of our Masters in Journalism next year. Now, with that, I'm going to open the floor to questions. Please, can I ask you to ask questions rather than make statements? That would be good. There's no limit on the questions that you want to ask. No topics are taboo. But statements are not a great idea, so please ask questions. If you could raise your hands, someone will come down and hand you the microphone. So let's get going.
Thank you very much for an interesting talk. I wondered about your perception of the demand side of the market for news and journalism, and whether you would agree with the suggestion that there's been a dilution of the products demanded from journalists, as there's more infotainment and as you said, the politics of opinion rather than the politics of facts, and whether there's some work to be done on the demand side of the market in terms of what is demanded from organisations that are trying to sell information, opinion and media into the marketplace.
Well, look, I think there's always been plenty of demand for entertainment and dull journalism. There's never been a market for dull journalism. However, what I sense is there is a growing demand for information and explanation. The people that I meet in both, you know, in my travels around the country and in my, you know, I regret to say, very extensive email correspondence. I've created a sort of a monster with my own digital presence because I get hundreds of emails. But what I find increase is that so many people are frustrated
that through the babble of angry debate, they can't actually get some trustworthy facts. And they're looking, because so often I think political issues are presented as though the only job, and this I think is because of in large part lack of time, the only job of the, you know, the media outlet, the newspaper, for using a generic term, is to present, do a he said, she said presentation. Whereas what I find is people are looking for some objective analysis, and from people that don't, from journalists that don't have an axe to grind. I mean, I certainly, and I can tell you as a politician, I know that my remarks, my, you know, speeches or commentary is much more persuasive and effective when it is objective. The minute people feel I'm running a political line, you can see a lot of them switching off. So I think there's a surfeit of partisanship, and that is a... So I do believe there is a market for that, but the problem is there's a market for it in terms of the readers. See, this is the terrible paradox of it, that if you are a newspaper journalist, more people are reading your copy than would ever have read it before. But it is attracting fewer dollars in advertising than it has ever had before. So you've got burgeoning audience, but dwindling revenue. And that's the, you know, therein lies the problem.
Thank you for that speech. It's certainly an in-depth analysis. I was just wondering, getting to the heart of the politics, if you'd read Lindsay Tanner's book, Sideshow, and whether you had an opinion on, you know, what he was sort of arguing about, you know, journalism and the Canberra sort of sideshow of what happens and, you know, what you've got to do now to get on TV.
Well, I haven't read Lindsay's book, I regret to say. He'll never forgive me for that. He'll never forgive me for not having bought it. Doesn't care whether I read it, but I've discussed it with him, and I know what his thesis is. Look, I think there's a lot of truth in it, but the criticism I'd make, the only counterpoint I'd make to what Lindsay's thesis is that, you know, the politicians have as much to share of the blame as the media. So it is a, you know, he says that in order to get on the news, you've got to do. Have cheap shots and do, you know, utter dumb one-liners. I don't think you need to do that. I mean, he's saying the media made us do it, but the media doesn't make you do anything. You know, you can take a different approach, and I don't think you know, enough of us do that, frankly.
We're going to take one from each side.
Okay.
You've used the words that the role of the media is to hold the powerful to account, and that echoed the words that Greg Harwood used just recently in his Smith lecture. But there doesn't appear to be any evidence of that in the journalism, in the media in Australia. But it's a lot of this he said, she said. How do we reverse that and get back to what journalism should be about, holding the powerful to account?
Well, I think part of the part of the problem is the question of resourcing. And obviously journalists and editors and proprietors have got to undertake it. But the challenge is the time and the resources. You see, it is so much quicker to knock out an opinion piece or to, you know, just write a reportage of, you know, he said this, and on the other hand, you know, the other side said something else, as opposed to actually doing the work, spending the hours and the days, weeks sometimes, to do that that work. And the difficulty is the lack of staff. Now, you know, one solution that friends of mine have talked about is, you know, is there a way that we can engage crowdsourcing? You know, if more information, as more information is put online, if we were, for example, to be able to achieve more government information and public information to be put online, and let's face it, there's a lot more now than there used to be, much, much more, is there a way, a creative way, media outlets, newspapers, again, I'm using that term totally generically, would be able to enlist a little work from a lot of people, a sort of a crowdsourcing model. You know, it's an interesting idea to kick around, but somehow or other, we need to find a way to restore the arms and legs, if you like, the lost arms and legs to journalism, because you can't pretend that you can slash the revenues and the profitability of newspapers and slash the newsrooms and nothing's going to change. I mean, you know, the management obviously will say that, and they, you know, we were all in their position, you'd have to put a brave face on it. You're hardly going to say, ladies and gentlemen, our newspaper isn't, you know, as a shadow of its former self. You're going to do the best you can. But at some point, I mean, Sam Chisholm, who some of you may recall, you know, a very feisty television executive in the context of cost cutting. I remember once said to us years ago, he said, well, you know, he said, cost cutting, remember this, he said, cost cutting is like giving blood. He said, you know, you can give blood, and then there's a point when you've given so much blood, you actually die. And so, you know, cost cutting is effective only up to a point.
In relation to what you've just said, as newsrooms shrink, is there now opportunity for an informed freelancer to have a new age?
Well, I think that this is the whole citizens' journalism story, and I think that's right. The question is, and social media lends itself to that. The problem, of course, is, you know, credibility, and this is really the exciting thing, you know, particularly for the young journalists here, because, you know, the barriers to entry, I mean, it's a tough environment you're going into. Don't you know that anyway? And if you didn't know that, I've certainly enlightened you tonight. He said bleakly, but the barriers to entry have never been lower. You know, and that of course is part of the problem the established organisations have got. So yes, I think there is an opportunity for that, but, you know, how do you get the scale? Now that's the challenge that we face. I mean, the old order is dying, the new order is yet to be born. That's what we should be focused on. I mean, I don't come here with a whole range of policies and solutions, nobody's got them. But it's very important that we focus on it, because the frustrating thing about this media inquiry, and I'm sure Ray Finkelstein will do a very good job, and he's a full marks to him and Matthew Ricketson, no objections to them at all. But we're talking about the issues of 20 years ago. We should be talking today about the issues of today and 20 years hence. And it may not even be 20 years hence. I mean, one of the interesting things, you know, about, and, you know, and I apologise for talking a lot about, well, I don't apologise at all. You may feel it tedious that I'm talking about the economics and the financials of newspapers a lot, but, you know, that ultimately is what pays the bills, right? So it is critically important. What is very interesting is that even though the internet, you know, got going, say, in the mid-90s, in a commercial sense, nonetheless, the real drop-off of newspaper revenues has only occurred in the last 4 or 5 years. Relatively recent. And this is one of the scary things, because often this is a mistake that people make in a whole range of areas, particularly where there's technology involved. People who are what you'd call early adopters or technological enthusiasts, and I tend to fall into that category, will say the change is coming, you know, this change is going to come. And inevitably, in my life anyway, when I've predicted some dramatic change is coming, I've been way ahead of it in time. And so, you know, my timing's absolutely wrong. Of course, it's very dangerous from an investment point of view. Remember, John Maynard Keynes once said the market can be irrational longer than you can stay solvent. You know, so if you're short the overvalued market, you want to make sure you've got plenty of resources to maintain your position. And so what's happened is people, the freight train's been coming on this issue, but a lot of people thought it wasn't ever going to come because it hadn't arrived, and then it came in a rush. So the challenge, I think, is to be looking forward. We've got to be talking about what the implications are for our own democracy. There's no point pretending that journalism, you know, politicians curse journalists and so forth, and we've all done that, and we all think we're treated unfairly and, you know, grind our teeth in rage. But the fact is, what I said earlier is not, you know, is not just warm words. The journalists of Australia are as important to our democracy as the parliamentarians. We wouldn't be a democracy without parliaments, obviously. We wouldn't be the democracy we are without a vigorous and independent press. So we're talking about a very serious issue.
Which side were we on? Yep. It's commonly said that there's a lack of national narrative, that there aren't great stories to be told, and that perhaps even that there's a decline in the quality of leadership because you don't have a visionary point of view. Do you think there's anything in that criticism?
Oh, I don't know, Barry. I think, sort of when I hear the word national narrative, I reach for my revolver. I'm not quite sure what you mean by national narrative. The line actually from the 1930s German play by Hans Joost is, when I hear the word culture, I reach for my Browning, but it means the same thing. The rather cynical remark. I think we do have plenty of stories in Australia, and I think we have plenty of stories that are important for all Australians. The issue, though, you know, one of the things we've got to think about, though, is, are we having those discussions together? You know, or is there a risk? And this has certainly happened in the United States. I mean, this is a matter of huge concern in the United States, the polarisation and partisanship of opinion and debate. Now, it's a very different political system to ours, but we don't want to end up where they are. I mean, they have got an utterly dysfunctional political system at the moment. And whatever our reservations about, you know, the Gillard government, and I've got plenty, or the hung parliament, and I've got plenty of reservations about that, we're a lot better off than they are in Washington. So, assuming I understand what you mean by a national narrative, I think we have many national narratives, many stories.
Malcolm, over the last couple of years, we've seen investors really clamour for a piece of these new media platforms, and we've seen Facebook notionally worth billions of dollars, and we've seen LinkedIn IPO at ridiculous multiples. But sure, we've also seen Rupert Murdoch write down the value of his MySpace acquisition to zero. In light of the dubious cash flows from some of these media platforms, where do you see the valuations heading
the valuations of technology properties have always been, you know, very, very dubious. I mean, what do the bankers do? The bankers assume a set of cash flows into the future, which are based on generally on pretty heroic assumptions, and then a terminal value at the end of the discounted cash flow period, which is based on another heroic multiple of the heroically assumed revenues. You know, who knows what they're worth? I mean, I agree with you. I mean, Rupert paid a lot of money for MySpace, and it's basically not worth anything now. Will Facebook go public at $100 billion and be worth nothing in a few years' time? I don't know, but I tell you what, Yahoo's a shadow of its former self. Yahoo used to be an absolute giant, and look what's happened to it. So, this is... I don't want to be Schumpeter's trumpeter here tonight, but this is creative destruction at work with a vengeance. Sorry, no, pun.
Yeah, it was very good.
Yeah, thank you.
Joseph Schumpeter.
Yeah.
Can we have... We're going to take two more questions.
Malcolm, you said that journalists spend too much time writing about the game of politics, with notable exceptions. I was wondering if you could name some notable exceptions, some of the individuals that you
sure.
think produce
well,
good journalism.
Well, look, this is the problem. If I do that, anyone I don't name will be terribly wounded. So I won't name any. I won't. I'll take that question on notice. But look, there is very good reporting, but the if you look at the political I don't think anyone's disagreeing with me here. The political coverage is overwhelmingly about the game. Overwhelmingly about the game. If I was back in my old life as a busy businessman and with an interest in politics, but doing lots of other things and only having a limited amount of time to pay attention to it, I would be really frustrated about how hard it is to actually find out what the real substance of the debates are. I mean, the questions that journalists at the Canberra Press Gallery are mostly concerned with are the who's up the greasy pole, who's coming down. I mean, how much has been written about Kevin and Julia, for heaven's sake? I mean, it's a soap opera. And I think part of the reason is because it's easier to write. It doesn't require a lot of time or analysis. And you can fill a lot of papers with a lot of space, whether it's, newsprint or digital space on the various news channels.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, can you join me in thanking